This is CliffCentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
Right, folks, good morning. Welcome to Auto Central, brought to you by Auto Trader, your trusted motoring marketplace. Join the conversation at Auto Trader SA. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you name the social platforms, we're there. And our hashtag is Auto Central. Usual suspects in studio today, Chad and George, how are you doing?
How's it?
Good. George took a bit of an injury, huh? Only half a George today.
Yeah, geez, I tell you what. I fell off my bicycle yesterday.
Well, we'll get into that.
That's why I stick to cars. Exactly. Really is, because I mean, I'm sorry. One of the funniest things for me is watching somebody fall off a bicycle. I know, because I used to ride plenty, and I know how easy it happens and how quick it happens and how painful it is. But I still find it hilarious.
No, one of my friends said to me, have you not heard of an internal combustion engine? You don't need a pedal.
Yeah, you don't need to.
And that's why I stick to cars now. Really is.
Hey? Exactly.
He injured his left side, but it seems he's all right now.
That was good. Very good. So, gents, a full show today. Just unpack quickly what we're going to run through. And under the hood, we're going to be chatting about Volvo to be all electric by 2019. Ooh. Opel's got a new range of Corsas. Well, they've kind of
revamped the range. Taking a look at the Corsa range.
We're going to unpack the four squares of car buying, which is quite an interesting
topic.
Actually,
very, very interesting.
We're going to do a full F1 recap in Burning Rubber. And then in Auto Talk, we're going to test drive a car like a pro. Avoid being a victim of car theft, traffic fines, and understanding the difference between fines and also what your rights are in a roadblock. So that could be pretty interesting. And then in Tech Talk, something really, really exciting, Michelin's new visionary concept tire, which I can't wait to get into. But yes, let's kick off with Volvo to be all electric by 2019. I mean, Volvo's president, Håkan Samuelsson, said that this is obviously about their customers, people's increasing demand for electrified cars, and they want to respond to their customers' current and future needs. And they're hoping to have over 1 million electrified cars on the roads by 2025. I mean, this is a big
step.
Can
I clarify that quickly?
Yes,
because
for sure, the
way it's being put forward there is that they're going
full electric.
Full EV. From, what are they saying, 2019 onwards.
Sure.
Not correct.
Okay.
But each one of their models will be available with either full EV or plug-in hybrid.
Okay.
So they're not doing away with the internal combustion motor.
Yeah.
What they're doing is they're just complementing that and supplementing that with an electric model or a plug-in hybrid or a hybrid model as part of that model range.
Now, a plug-in hybrid, Chad, just elaborate on that for people like me, please.
EV and PHEV is your electric vehicle, which is your full electric. So you've got to think of like the Nissan Leaf and the BMW i3, your Teslas. Those are full electric vehicles. Generally, it goes without saying that it needs to be plugged in. That's how you recharge it.
Sure. Mm.
Then your PHEV is your plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, which means that it runs an internal combustion motor as well.
But you can switch that off if you like.
Yeah, you can switch it off. So you can either charge it through a wall socket, that's the plug-in bit, but then the hybrid bit means that it's still running an internal combustion motor that may very well feed and charge the batteries.
Was that similar to, was it the i3 or the i8 that you
drove?
That's
similar to the i8.
i8.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the i3 is a full EV vehicle, but you get the REX version, which is the range extender version that has a petrol motor, but that petrol motor only acts as a generator, doesn't power the wheels.
Okay.
So it's still the power going to the wheels comes from an electric motor no matter what you do, despite the fact that it can use fuel. That fuel is just used to recharge
the batteries.
It's not used to power the vehicle.
Cool. And then just quickly, I see that out of the five new derivatives that they're going to be, that they're going to roll out, three are Volvo cars. And I think this is really exciting.
Yeah,
that two models are going to be high-performance models from Polestar.
Mm. So it's really exciting. I mean, for the proper petrol head, it's great to see that despite the switch towards electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles and that, the manufacturers are still keeping in mind that there are people that want performance vehicles. It's not all doom and gloom. And the electric motor, and that's fantastic, because the electric motor provides instantaneous torque and silly amounts of it. So getting that in a performance vehicle I mean, it makes it amazing. It's a whole new level. What an exciting time to live in.
Well, I know that the do you want to jump in? Yeah,
no, sorry, you believe it or not, the platinum price, the silver price took a pounding because Volvo is not going to be producing the catalytic converters in those cars.
Yeah, platinum. Yeah,
sure.
It's platinum. Yeah, yeah, platinum. They're using those catalytic converters. So guess what? Platinum price takes a pounding when Volvo announced this this vision.
Jeez, luck.
Now, no doubt that they're going to want to go to full EV somewhere down the line.
Sure.
But they're going to still need some catalytic converters, and that because of the strict emissions regulations. So yep. I don't think they're going to be doing away with catalytic converters just yet, but it's down the road. And yes, I can see this changing things up. And so, ordered a platinum ring recently.
Yeah, well, I mean, I see that they want to be climate neutral. They want to have climate neutral manufacturing operations by 2025.
Zero impact, yeah.
Zero impact, which is really good.
Which means that the catalytic converter has to go.
Yeah, sure.
Effectively.
So what does that thing actually do?
Catalytic converter takes the harmful carcinogens that are in the exhaust gases and basically purifies it. It's a purifier. It's a filter.
Oh, okay.
A catalytic converter is just a purifier. It's a filter, and it removes a lot of the gunk and the carcinogens in exhaust gases and allows a cleaner CO2 to be.
The downside with a catalytic converter, though, is what it collects in its little filter has to go somewhere. You've got to get rid of it somewhere.
Sure.
So the fact that it's not going into the atmosphere is great, but at the end of the day, you've got to dispose of that thing.
You do need to dispose of it, but the lifespan of a catalytic converter is several years, you know, many, many years.
Yeah.
So before you need to have a catalytic converter replaced, it's going to falter for many, many years. It's not nothing to worry about. But then, yes, at the end of that lifespan, where does it go? Where does it go? At least it's not going out into the air, into the oxygen,
sure.
And we're not consuming it. We're not breathing it in, per se. And I'm sure there's a responsible way of disposing
of that. Well, look, if these guys are inventing cars that are going to drive on electric motors, I'm sure they can come up with a decent way to get to dispose of that,
yeah.
You know? Other types of things. So just quickly, our team from Autotrader got hold of Brent Ellis, who's the media relations manager from Volvo, to find out what is it going to affect us here in South Africa. And he just had to say that it's likely that those cars will come to South Africa, the Polestar ones essentially, but obviously they can't disclose make models and just yet.
I don't think anything's set in stone. There's just preliminary sort of discussions and plans on that, but South Africa's infrastructure at the moment is still a couple years behind in terms of accepting plug-in hybrid vehicles, charging stations, charging points around. We're needing to get a little more first world before it becomes a real reality. So add a few years to.
Well, I mean, if you just have a look at this, so Volvo, BMW, obviously all, and you know, a lot of other manufacturers are all going through this, this change. And I think it's a great change, but it is really going to revolutionize and change the industry that we've come to know and have worked in for so long.
It's not something to fear.
No, I totally embrace it. I really think it's going to be a good thing for everybody.
The sooner it happens, the better.
Exactly. You know. Okay, gents, quickly. Chad, tell me about Opel. So I see that they've revised their Corsa range with improved specs for some variants and reduced prices across the range. I read a lot of, about the range that's coming out, but you're in a better position to unpack that for me.
Well, I mean, there's not too much about it. I mean, they've taken a look at the pricing and then they've introduced a new motor. So the entry-level Essentia, which is basically their lowest spec of the Corsa, that's now getting the 1-liter three-cylinder engine, where it was the little 1.4 naturally aspirated four-cylinder. They're now going to the 1-liter three-cylinder engine, which makes 66 kilowatts and 117 newton meters, and they're mating that to a six-speed manual. So, I mean, it's a fantastic little motor. I really do like these small little 1-liter three-cylinder motors. They really are engaging, fun to drive, and relatively fuel efficient if you're not driving everywhere with your foot buried in the carpet.
Sure.
Is it turbocharged?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and then they've got the Enjoy, the Auto Enjoy, and then the good old Corsa Sport. Because I see that they had a Cosmo as well, but I see that they've kind of
sort of
taken the Sport and the Cosmo and they've put them together. So they've got the outside styling of the Sport and the inside styling of the Cosmo, and
sort of blending it there. Yeah,
my sister used to have a Corsa Sport, and I absolutely loved that
Corsas
car.
Corsas were cool cars.
They were cool
cracking
cars.
Little car. And I think the new one is also a very, very good car, but I'm not seeing enough of them on the road. So I think that's what's prompted this sort of
Well, do you think with the talk in the marketplace about Opel and GM and all that kind of stuff is kind of
even before, I mean,
we've spoken about it. It might have stifled it a bit, but I mean, this is just
it's a nice refresh.
100% to say that these cars are here to stay.
You probably find it's gonna stimulate the Corsa sales. So
yeah.
You know, it remains to be seen in the economy, but it's a nice refresh.
And not too many manufacturers dropping their prices, even if it is a couple of $100, but they obviously are being aware of, you know, consumers' pockets and what people can and can't spend.
What many of the guys are doing, and we saw it now recently with the Kia Rio launch, was that they're actually trying to stick to the old pricing.
Okay.
The current Kia Rio starts at exactly the same price with the old Kia Rio. So the brand new, all new, and I mean, it's a new chassis, new body, new range of everything, and it's coming in at the same price, and that is just fantastic, because as soon as they bring out a new product, usually there's a considerable hike, and this is what has pushed vehicle prices so high.
Well,
it's nice that Opel is putting this drive in just to sort of, and I think it's just to cement them that, listen, we're here to stay, and we still have your best interests at heart. Yes, it's marketing tactic, and it's trying to get more people into courses, and I really think they should, because it's a great car.
It is a great
and
car.
Hasn't been selling well even before the announcement that GM is pulling out of the country.
Okay, quickly, guys, now talking about getting into a new car, I came across an article which really, really surprised me, and having been through the process a number of times and not being kind of, you know, too clued up on what you can and how to structure a car deal. So I'd like to just unpack that for a couple of minutes. We don't have too much time, but let's just get into it. Apparently, there's a formula. Yes. Mm. And if you take a big square and you break that into quarters, you're left with four squares. And if you put price, trade-ins, deposit, and your monthly installments into each block, when you are unpacking a car deal, you've seen a car, you like it, you're now in the negotiation phase with the car sales representative, these are the four key kind of pillars that you should base your deal on. George, do you want to touch on this a bit?
I think the reason these four exist is because they are not mutually exclusive. They impact each other. So if you change one, it will change the others. So if you think about the price of the car that you want to get into, is impacted by potentially the trade-in that you're trying to get out of.
Yep.
I mean, often people owe more than what the trade-in car is worth.
Yep.
And then
they'll load that additional spend onto the new car.
Yes. So often the dealers kind of load that to try and, you know, help you buy the car that you're trying to buy. So there you can see there's that kind of overlap.
Mm.
And all of that impacts the finance and the repayment, the interest rate, etc. I mean, there's one thing that I would add, though, to monthly payment, and that is finance and insurance. So in that monthly payment, there's two components. One's finance, the other one's insurance, because both of them are important on a car.
Mm.
But every one of those four impact the other if changed.
And I think it's about understanding all four of those in isolation. So I think the first place to start is understand what your cash price of your vehicle is in isolation of your trade and your deposit and what your monthly installments would be, because that will give you the kind of market value of what that car's actually worth.
So I mean, I think every single one of those four needs to be understood independently of each other.
100%.
But then when going into the deal, understand how they impact each other.
Correct.
Because you could be getting yourself into another car where when it's loaded is then immediately overvalued.
Yeah. Well, exactly. So I mean, if I take myself as a consumer and as an example of one, you know, if you wanted to get into a new car, I think what people worry about is, can I afford it on the monthly basis? I mean, I don't have the cash to buy it outright. So I'm really worried about what my monthly repayment's going to be. And if that fits my pocket, you know, happy days for now. But in the long run, what have I actually done to myself? I'm probably incurring a hell of a load more debt on the vehicle.
So, I mean, I don't think it's a secret that as soon as you drive a new car off the showroom floor, it's immediately depreciated.
Sure.
I mean, it becomes a second-hand car immediately. But, you know, that's par for the course for any car.
Yeah.
And cars don't increase in value. They decrease in value unless it's a classic car. Yeah. So taking the future value of that car into account, even if it's a depreciating asset, is important in not just looking at the monthly repayment.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, for the listeners out there, so those are your four kind of key blocks, you know, your price, your trading value, your deposits, and what your monthly installment's going to be. And if you understand those in isolation, you can probably work out a deal that's going to best suit you as a consumer at the end of the day.
I think you said it right at the beginning there. The best way to do this, take a blank piece of paper, draw a big square, a big cross in the center, have the four blocks, and then write down each of the numbers in each of those blocks for the car. car deal. And then as the car deal progresses in terms of trading value, finance and deposit and insurance, change the blocks relative to each other.
And actually see what deal is going to suit you best at the end of the day. And also using, you know, doing your research properly. So jumping onto AutoTrader, you know, and having a look at, you know, vehicle check and having a look at what your car could be priced. I mean, there's obviously things like, you know, wear and tear and dings that we can't assist you with, but it will give you an understanding of what the actual market value of that car could be worth.
Do your research properly.
So you have to do your research. Well, gents, that's pretty much it. Just still carrying on with the news. George, obviously you being a fan, what a fantastic F1 Grand Prix in Austria this weekend. Really, really amazing.
It was amazing. Lewis Hamilton unfortunately had a grid penalty.
Because they changed his gearbox.
So they're only allowed to use a certain number of gearboxes in one season. So he had a grid penalty and had to drop back to eighth position. And finished on the podium.
In
fourth. And almost finished on the podium because he almost passed Ricciardo.
Right near the end. Lap 70. Yeah. And I think it was on the third last corner. He did him down that straight.
Yeah.
And this is the most frustrating thing for me about Formula One. Is there's not only ever one race. There's obviously a race for the checkered flag, but there are so many
little races
inside the big race. I get completely confused as to, I mean, I know he's going to come first, second, and third. You can see it, but to try and keep track and understand what's going on and pits and tires and
that's what makes it interesting. Motorsport is the strategy
in that. It's not just about who's built the fastest car.
Yeah, it's not just about getting in with a tank of petrol and driving around a track a couple of times. There really is a lot of thinking into that.
So, I mean, let's talk for a second about the incident that the entire world talking about, and that was last race's incident with Vettel and Hamilton, and Vettel driving into Hamilton. Now I think that it was a good thing for Formula One, because guess what? That emotion just shows that Vettel was human.
100%.
Not that it was right. I mean, I don't condone the fact that he kind of turned into Hamilton, but it shows that he's human. And for many, many years, Formula One was had this cloak of, well, these drivers are robots. That incident showed that they're not robots. They
behind a wheel.
They actually have feelings.
No, of course they do.
You know, and not that it's right, but I think it did more good for Formula One than it did
bad. Think, you know, Vettel obviously got upset. He thought that Hamilton brake checked him, as you could hear over the radio. And then he drove alongside him and just gave him a bit of a, how's your father? Hamilton, I thought, was going to burst into tears and cry. I mean, this weekend, the commentators were speaking about him going, oh, he doesn't seem himself. He's down in the dumps. I'm like, come on, dude.
He's throwing a tantrum.
You are one of the most, you know, the highest paid sports entertainers, racing car drivers. You're living the dream. Like, okay, cool. You had a cuck week last weekend. Just, you know, get over it. You know, and well done for coming forth. I'm glad you didn't pass Ricciardo, because I actually happen to like the guy. But one thing I do want to talk about is, what a phenomenal venue.
Oh, yeah.
Red Bull Ring.
I mean, I was, heels are alive with the sound of music. It really was, you know.
Can I just throw a complete sort of left field spanner in the works here?
You've got a minute to do that.
Yeah. I think that this is contrived.
You think so?
I think this is staged.
A conspiracy theorist.
That the Hamilton-Vettel sort of debacle was scripted.
Oh, wow.
Do you reckon? I don't know.
Liberty's in there and they're pushing hard for the viewership. They're doing wonderful things with it. When was the last time we had a proper sort of Hunt Lauda, Prost, Senna sort of rivalry?
The guys having a full go at each other.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, we know, brought droves.
I mean, even in Schumacher's days, the amount of flipping naughty tricks he got up to.
But there was never one rival. There was always a whole batch of them, and because he was leading it in such a procession, it was probably one of the lowest times for viewership. Of Formula One.
But it was becoming boring, wasn't it?
That's it. It was becoming a bit of a procession. So it wouldn't surprise me if this is a little bit contrived and they're saying, guys, go out there, mix it up a little bit. None of those incidents damaged the cars to the point where they were the drivers were stranded and they had to climb out. Come on, this was lightweight contact.
Well, listen, I can tell you now, if that was scripted, it certainly worked because there's a buzz in F1 at the moment and it really is fantastic. So that's
every story needs a villain.
You know, a little bit of burning rubber there and checking in with what happened in F1. And
so Hamilton is still 20 points behind Vettel. And,
yes.
You know, I'm hoping that it ends that way at the end of the year.
But Bottas is now in striking distance.
Yes, he is on 136. So so he's got some work to do, but he can get there.
I see Wolf. Toto Wolf kind of apologized he's saying that they let Hamilton down.
Aww.
Oh, no. Shame.
Poor guy. His ego was bruised.
Anyway, let's...
home to Nicole.
Auto talk. Let's get into some topical content here, chaps. I know, also, again, when you're going to test, I always feel, I don't know, guilty or... You know, you don't want to push a car when you're taking it for a test drive.
It's not yours.
It's not yours, and you don't know how long you can take it for. Mm. There's no kind of right or wrong. I mean, some people, you know, I mean, I would never do a wheel spin in a car that I'm trying to test drive, but there are people out there who would. So there are kind of four or five key pointers to doing a test drive. This article is on our site, and thanks to Nay for writing it, because it actually opened my eyes to what you can and where you stand and what you shouldn't be checking for. So
yes, and I feel that the general test drive principle, especially here in this country, is massively flawed. And
is it different elsewhere?
And it's not successful. I think that there are just... Peugeot tried it where they came to you for the test drive.
I remember that.
And that is considerably better because, I mean, there's a couple points that Anais has highlighted here that I'm sure you're going to go through unless you're wanting me to run with it.
No, well, I think let's just do the first one. So do a proper inspection and what does that entail, Chad?
It does mean going around the vehicle, taking a look for anomalies. You need to, ideally, you want to know the vehicle. And yes, if you are one of those, chances if you're listening to this, you know a little bit about cars. If you can, take somebody with a fresh pair of eyes, doesn't hurt, and especially somebody that knows about vehicles or about that model in particular.
Sure.
If you do have a friend, if you can find, take them with.
If you can find a friend.
Yeah. You know what my biggest inspection test is for a car?
No, what is it?
Is I run my finger along every single body panel gap.
Okay.
My finger. So your finger can feel when there's a change in the size of that gap.
So and you're talking about like where the front door would meet the wheel arch.
Yes.
Okay, so there's a panel gap.
Your finger along every single panel gap.
Okay.
Because you would be amazed at how your brain picks up a change in that gap.
Okay.
And if a change in that gap occurs down that particular panel, then there's been some bodywork because those things are usually straight.
So they're not essentially coming off the line like that with that kind of little bit of a
variance. There may be a slight variance depending on what sort of vehicle you're looking
at. Well, there's usually a consistent variance.
There should be a consistent.
Because in the factory that there won't be a slight bulge in one of the panels where the gap gets smaller and then bigger.
Yeah.
So that is one of my biggest tests is run your finger along every gap.
I'll definitely do that the next time I test drive a car. I think another thing to check is battery terminal should be free of buildup. What would that tell me as a
just
potential car buyer?
Alludes to maintenance and how the vehicle has been kept. You want to see that the engine bay is neat and tidy, and you're not wanting a discrepancy in the age of components anywhere around the car, in the engine bay, in the interior, in the boot, anything of the sort. So if towards the back end of the engine bay, the stuff looks slightly corroded, aged. You know how rubber and plastic start looking after a few years and that.
Yeah.
But in the front, it looks brand spanking new.
Then there's
some
example.
They've been replaced. They're not of the same age. So you've got to watch that. Left and right as well. Does one headlight look a little brighter than the other? Does one taillight look a little brighter than the other? If it does, why has it been replaced?
And is the
has
car
it been in an accident or was it just cracked or
is
something?
Is the car salesperson at liberty to tell you that their car has been worked on? I mean, they should be telling you that kind of stuff.
If he's honest, but they're trying to make a sale. Come on, at the end of the day, I'm not saying that they're all crooks, but they're not going to sit there and point out every single fault and flaw. Ask them about it, though, chances are they will tell you.
Okay.
No, that was replaced. If you've noticed it.
Yeah. I think you're right. They will tell you, but often, a dealership will take a trade in and they don't even know that something's happened to that car.
So exactly.
So you know, it's not a case of the dealership knows everything about that car.
And how many people selling their cars are going to actually go to the dealer and say, "Oh, look, I want to trade this, and I crashed it 3 weeks ago.
No.
I fixed A, B, C, D,
not
E, F, and G. Let me make this problem yours."
Exactly.
And then, you know, we label the dealer, "Oh, this guy sold me a dodgy car," but, you know,
it's owners. It's owners and the likes.
Another thing is the wheel arches, and Chad's probably alluding to that now, is check the wheel arches, because often one wheel arch if there's been a, let's say, a right front accident, one wheel arch will be a lot cleaner. The plastic will be a lot newer because they replace that inner lining when there's a, let's say, a right front crash, and look for that new inner lining versus the other three.
Okay.
Always just it's something that looks out of place. Chances are it is.
And checking paint and stuff like that on the inside of the engine bay.
Again, your finger is an amazing thing. If you run your finger along the paint, often you can feel the difference between the original paint and any other paint. Rougher, less, provides more friction, that kind of thing. You'd be amazed at how your senses
different ages
work.
And different treatments, But one of the best things to do, I bought a vehicle not too long ago, and was that I requested a tech inspection. And if the dealer really wants to, and you're buying from a reputable dealer, if he really wants to sell that car, he's going to spend the few hundred rand that it is to have a Decra inspection or something of the sorts, or an AA 131-point check. And they're going to go through the vehicle, and they're going to take a look, and they're going to tell you not only mechanically, okay, that fender, one or two stone chips there, and a little pressure dent there and there, whatever. They're going to go, and they're going to test like the braking capability of on each wheel.
Yes.
So they'll measure the tread on the tires, and then they'll say there's so many kilograms of force braking on front right, front left, et cetera, et cetera. And they're going to give you a full breakdown, and it gives you a lot of peace of mind. Mm. I wouldn't have bought my car without that inspection.
100%. But I mean, now we've only spoken about actually like checking the car out on the floor. Now we haven't even got into the vehicle.
No, you haven't even gotten into it.
So for me, and I'm not one for making small talk with the best of people, but and A alludes to taking the car for about an hour, which will give you enough time to really feel the car and drive it and stuff like that.
That's where I say the system's flawed locally.
Are you allowed to take the car without the sales guy in it?
Nowadays, they won't let you.
No, they won't.
Many, many years ago, they used to. But the best thing to do, stick a guy in the back seat.
Tell him to shut up.
and don't turn the radio on.
No.
Listen to the car and feel the car. Okay. Because, your senses will tell you.
Yes.
And I see Arne writes about drive all the cars in one day. Very good idea, because you can compare one to the other. You go across, back to back. You go one day to the next, you're not really going to remember yesterday's.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, she's talking about absolutely checking everything. So listening to sounds that are coming from the engine, if there's any kind of knocking or banging sounds that are coming from, I don't know, doors that are, or loose panels. So those are all kind of things that one should take into consideration.
What I would highly recommend, and it does help, Arne says it here, and drive it on a road that is familiar to you. And that makes a massive difference. A road that you drive every day, you know how your car feels in it, and you'll be able to tell the difference whether the car that you're interested in purchasing is better or worse on that stretch of road. And I'm talking about a smooth surface and particularly an uneven surface. And that's where manufacturers like Peugeot and Citroën were doing well, where they would come to you with the model you're looking for the test drive. That means that it's in your area and you can drive it. Sadly, when you're purchasing something, you stay in Joburg, you're purchasing something in Pretoria, you don't know the roads, you're at the whim of the salesman. He's going to take you on the roads that highlight the best characteristics of that vehicle and not highlight the weaknesses. So it is a little tricky. See if you can get an extended drive, and definitely try and get the vehicle up to highway speed and drive it for at least, let's say, 20 to 25 minutes, and watch that temperature gauge. If it's still fitted with a temperature gauge, watch the temperature gauge and see what it does. If it's getting warm too quickly, it's a concern as well. Okay, if it gets up to temperature too quickly, it should have a steady rate. And if it's not getting warm, also a concern. You know, so any untoward, unsuspected sort of occurrences with the temperature gauge should be a big, big warning sign. Also, checking for smoke on the startup.
Okay.
That alludes to problems that are going to creep in later down the line. A little bit of a puff of unburned fuel is not a problem, but if it sits there for 10-15 seconds and there's a little bit of smoke coming out and then it only clears, it alludes to worn valve stem seals.
Okay, geez luck. Well, and then the last point that I know alludes to is obviously test drive the correct specs. So don't take the diesel for a drive if you want to buy the petrol.
Please do take it from me. I am one of those that I drive a lot of vehicles, and I've had many vehicles come in and out, and a vehicle that I drove on launch, let's say, was, let's say, the diesel automatic, and it was a lovely car. Then when I get it to review, I get the manual petrol, and I realize, wow, but that's actually a bit of a shoddy combination, having the petrol manual. The one that you actually want in the range is the diesel automatic. So if you're interested in, let's say, a automatic diesel or a manual diesel, go and drive that one. Don't sit there and think that the petrol is going to feel the same with the automatic gearbox. Yeah, it's not.
It's not.
It's going to feel different.
Yeah, you'll pick up that difference. All right, guys. Well, I think, you know, some really good insight there into how to and what to check for when you're doing a test drive. Just quickly on closing that subject there, if I am on the drive and I hear a knocking or I feel a rattling, is that something that I'll obviously, you know, let the salesperson know? And are they then obliged to fix that? Or is it a case of like footstoots, take it as it comes? Is that a conversation that you have with the dealer?
It's a conversation that you have on the day. And you sit there and you say, well, listen, there's that knocking sound. I don't know what it is. I need that inspected. If they want to make the deal, they're going to take a look into it, or they're going to tell you it is X, Y, and Z. Mm. Don't let them say, oh, no, it's nothing.
Yeah.
If it's concerning you now, it's a concern.
Yeah.
You're going to either walk away or they're going to fix it. It's those two options.
Because you must look at the car for a good price, but you're going to live with that knocking sound and you're going to hate yourself for buying that car. Mm. You know?
The good price isn't going to matter if it's going to cost you 30, 40,000 rand down the line to sit there and replace suspension components that are worn out.
Okay.
So, no, don't. Rather walk away. Don't be in a rush to buy.
Yeah, because it is a big investment at the end of the day. Second largest investment that you'll probably make.
And if you're financing.
Or third after having children.
If you're financing it,
you're
stuck with that vehicle, not just for a few months. You're stuck with it for quite a while. Otherwise, you are losing money because of the initial interest and everything that is attached to it.
All right. Well, great article on autotrader.co.za. You can go and check it out. The next thing I want to chat with you guys is I was coming back from Durbs 2 weeks ago and I got pulled over by an officer. And to be completely honest, I am at the whim of any traffic officer that pulls me over because I don't really know, you know, where I stand in terms of what can you be arrested for, what can't you be arrested for, you know, what are the different kinds of fines that traffic officers can issue to, you know, to a driver or a road user. And I just thought let's just talk about that quickly because essentially it's not that difficult. You get two types of traffic fines. You get a Section 341 fine, which you'll either receive in the mail. It will be either be left on your vehicle if you violated the law or if you've been caught on camera. So these are tickets that essentially be sent to you or not given to you in person.
Yeah.
And then you get a Section 56 fine, which you will personally receive from an officer who has pulled you over for breaking the law.
That is as good as a summons.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say.
That's the main difference. The one is not a summons. The one is a notice that there is a fine on your name. Once that proceeds, once that passes certain dates, then it will go on to a summons as the reminder.
Yeah.
Then they are equal. Then you've got a date to appear in court.
Yes.
Then it has to be paid. The admission of guilt or the court has to be paid, or you need to appear in court. One or the other. Or you can contest it, of course. Those are your three options.
Well, you are allowed to contest if you think that you haven't broken the law.
I think in any scenario, you're allowed to contest. I mean, the fact that it's a summons, taken one step out of the process.
Yeah.
But it is a notice to appear in court if you don't comply with the fine or whatever.
Well, because essentially our constitution says that if you are accused of something, you are regarded as innocent until proven guilty. Yeah. So you might have the ticket. You are still essentially innocent at that point.
Well,
correct.
Yeah, I mean,
unless you know you've broken
that's the reason I suppose it's a summons is because you have to appear before a judge and he has to kind of make his ruling,
his judgment on it. Yeah. And there in the court case they will present whether it is the reading or anything of the sorts on the day or the photographic evidence or something of the sorts, and it is a massive faff. Paying it ahead of time, especially if you sit there and you know, and there's the infringement photo and everything on the notice. Trust me, paying it is a lot easier.
Okay. Well, listen, we're going to get into our car review shortly, but just before we do that, I just want to touch on. So, just for the listeners out there, uninformed. Some of them are a uniformed officer has the right to stop any motorist for a routine check for a traffic offence or to check a suspected stolen or suspicious drivers. So if a cop pulls you over, you have to pull over. Mm-hmm. There's no driving past him. I think if there's one thing that I have learned is you might be on your way to a meeting, you might have had a bad day, you might have had an argument with someone that morning. When that cop pulls you over, there is one rule that I always play with, and that is give him or her the respect that they deserve. Mm-hmm. I always greet with a hello, how are you doing? Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, here's my driver's license. Thanks very much. You guys are doing a fantastic job. Now, please, can I try and talk myself out of this fine? That's that's my go-to strategy with these guys.
I think if you follow that rule of thumb, just be respectful. Nine times out of ten.
Respectful and pleasant.
You're not going to have a bad experience.
Yeah.
You know, you've probably done something that has crossed the line. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways to deal with corrupt police officers, and it's not antagonizing them.
No,
exactly. So
you are, and this is the one thing that has been confirmed, you are permitted to film them.
Yes.
Okay. Should you be stopped in a roadblock, you're more than welcome to start your camera up. Might I suggest alerting the police officer?
Tell him yes.
To the fact.
Well,
thank you. Officer, I've pulled over and I'll comply with your request. Please do note that you are being filmed.
Yeah, well, the SAPS Standing Order 156 says that an officer cannot stop you from taking a photo or video, and an officer cannot seize, damage your equipment, and an officer cannot force you to delete any footage. So you are well within your rights to film the incident, mm-hmm. because essentially, if you are going to dispute it in court, you're allowed to collect as much evidence as you Correct. Wish to obviously substantiate your
plot
in the incident.
Your case in it, yeah. So I would highly recommend it. If you can, dash cams. Get a dash cam, let it continue recording, let it record the audio, something of the sorts. Not only is that going to help you down the line when it comes time to an accident, but really a dash cam, they're not that expensive. And a quick turnaround of that dash cam so that it's facing on you and the officer, and you've got it there. Mm. And you can see, you've now got evidence of... It's going to deflate the situation straight off the bat.
Yeah.
And if we all do this, it's going to start curbing corruption.
Exactly.
They're not going to be able to.
Everybody will watch their P's and Q's if they know they're recorded.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So just quickly, lastly, if you intentionally or unlawfully violate the dignity of an officer, you could be taken into custody. Mm-hmm. So, for example, any racial slurs, hate speech, or, you know, if you just plain right or nasty to an officer, they can...
Disrespectful.
As a whole. But it says here, you cannot be arrested for being rude. Now, that's quite difficult because... What's rude in my world and what's rude in your world is probably two different rudes. So anyway, we'll leave it on that. But you are well within your right to film. Yeah. Gents, let's get into the driver's seat. Both of you, I've bumped into you in the passages at the office. Chad, this is part of your job and what you do. George, you happen to be able to allow... You also get to drive nice cars as well. And both of you guys...
Yeah, we both sampled this one.
Have sampled this one, and that is the Alfa Giulia.
Alfa Giulia, yes. And a return... I don't want to say return, but after the 159, which was not exactly winning people over, return to the D segment for Alfa Romeo in the form of the Giulia. Of course, the one that everybody knows is the QV, which is the fire-breathing 257 kilowatt monster with that 2.9-liter twin-turbo V6.
Quadrifoglio.
Yeah, the Quadrifoglio, the QV. And this is now... We actually climbed into a base spec. So there's three models on offer. There's the 2-liter turbo base, 2-liter turbo super, and then, of course, the QV. We were in a base. And despite the fact that we were in a base, I completely fell in love with this car. It's not because it's an Alfa and it's got character and, ooh, it looks great. And no, just as a whole, this is a stonking good car.
Because I always thought Alfas had a bad rep.
They do. They've got a terrible rep.
Yeah, they do for reliability, in my opinion. But yeah. I can agree with Chad. When I climbed into that car and I drove 100 meters, I could immediately feel this car is well made. It was really, really nice.
That it's something special. Yeah. And they've taken a slightly different approach in terms of design and the interior. They haven't gone over the top, but it is a very attractive looking car. Yes, there's a couple styling cues that are borrowed from others, but that just makes it palatable and acceptable. It's not a wild departure. The 159 definitely stood out on the road completely. This one tends to blend in a little more. It's a little more subtle. Of course, you're going to notice the big shield-like grill on the front.
Yeah.
But should you catch it from the back or from the side or a three-quarter, you're not necessarily going to see that, and it's going to sort of blend in. You're going to...
I thought it looked like an Audi. Mm. From the back, it...
There are some traits, yeah.
It looks a little bit like an Audi. On a second look, you can see it's not an Audi, but from the front, you can see it's an Alfa. Mm.
But, I mean, this one's powered by a 2-litre motor, and while it's not necessarily, like I say, that fire-breathing 2.9 twin-turbo V6, it's still pretty pokey, and you can feel that there's a lot of the DNA. What it felt like to me is that they designed the QV to go up against the likes of the C63, the M3, and a lot of those other big bruisers, and yeah. I mean, especially those two, because those are the real big ones. Mm. And they designed the QV to go up against that, so it had to be faster, it had to handle better, it had to be more dynamic. And once they were done designing that one, they said, okay, that's a great car. But the layman doesn't need that sort of power. So let's just pull that engine out and let's put a slightly
dumbed down,
less powerful, smaller, more economical engine in it. We make the brakes just a little bit smaller and we soften the suspension a little bit. the rest of the car is still the same. It's still got that same sort of feel to it that is massively dynamic. You want to feel what the QV's like? Go and drive the 2 liter in either the base or the super and just imagine it with more power.
Well, you talk like that. I mean, they did the same thing with the Mustang. They brought out the 2 liter turbo,
2.3 liter
turbo, which is the dumbed down version of the Big Daddy. And you know, you'd expect there to be a massive difference between the you know, the big traditional kind of Mustang and the dumbed down version, and you could in that car. In this car, I don't believe there's a massive difference except for its sheer raw power.
Yeah, the power. Naturally, the braking and the handling is going to be considerably better in the QV, but it's that's the performance aspects. As the build quality, the feel, the way that it turns, the way that it handles for the most part is, it's just a scaled down version. It feels just like a younger QV.
Yeah. And like do you think people who naturally wouldn't have, you know, considered Alfa as a brand, if they took this for a drive, they might change perceptions?
Yep. They're a moron if they don't.
Really?
Seriously. I'm going to go out and I'm going to say it. Well, you're in the market for a 3 Series and we're talking like 320 or a C200 or an Audi A4,
yeah,
2 liter TFSI, something of the sorts, even the Jaguar XE. Is up there, Lexus IS200. This is the sort of company that it's keeping.
Family sedan.
You got to go, a D-segment family sedan, actually an executive sedan. You can't get the likes of the Elantra and that's still going to go into that segment.
Sure.
But the ones that are, it's priced right. It's priced right, and you're a moron if you don't go and at least test drive the Alfa and consider it.
Mm.
It really is. I'm just praying, I'm hoping, it's really early days, but I really am hoping that it's not plagued with similar reliability and running issues as the previous Alphas. I don't believe it is.
Technology has moved on.
It has, and it's been a while. They sat on this car for a long time, ironing out a lot of the little idiosyncrasies.
Well, Ferrari was involved, so
they don't want to admit it.
But they were. No.
Well, Ferrari don't want to admit that they had a hand in the development of the car.
Well, they were just helping out, like the poor cousin.
It's beneath them.
Them. Really?
It's when it's your delinquent cousin.
Yeah.
With a bad reputation.
Yes.
Do you want to be seen at the bar with him?
You can see the gear shift pedals.
Yeah.
That's Ferrari. You know, it's huge. I've never seen a car.
You're talking about
that.
The pedal shift.
Yes.
Because I saw your article on your blog said that they were really, really big.
Very,
so
very
not,
big.
Not hard to find.
Not hard to find.
Well, you couldn't drive it today, could you?
No, not today. But it's still automatic, so you can still drive with one arm.
Or just change up.
And a lovely gearbox. Really is. I've got a video that's going to be coming out on this in a short while. And it's probably going to be a bit lengthy because I'm gushing about this car.
Yes.
And it is a car. I'm not an Alfa Romeo fan. I'm not Alfisti. I haven't been because I'm like, I've had women in my life. I know what trouble is.
Yes.
I don't need that again. Okay.
Chad single for another 6 months.
There we go, hundreds. And it's this mouth. And the Alfa Romeo is really just sort of lured me into, well, I actually want to own one. I really do. And you are a moron if you don't consider it.
Well, I was surprised. I mean, you know, not coming from a kind of car nut kind of family, but I always got told no, Alphas would just give you problems, so leave them alone. And it's nice to hear that here's one that we hope
we're hoping.
So, well, that's really, really fantastic.
The proof is in the pudding, and we'll see what happens down the line. It may turn out to be the dud of the 21st century. Yeah, 21st, huh? Yeah,
yes,
okay, just checking.
So, how long do we give it before we start? 3, 4, 5 months?
It's gonna take a little while before it starts, but I tell you what, just locally, in a year's time, there's going to be a couple of demos that are out there, and just because of the stigma around Alfa Romeo, I don't think they're going to hold their value as well as some of the other vehicles. That may put you off buying it, but trust me, that is the price worth paying for having the pleasure of driving it.
Okay.
But it is going to make a fantastic second-hand buy in a year to 2 years.
And they're fully launched in the country. You can go to the dealerships now and test drive them and stuff like that.
I believe there's still a waiting list for the QV. They're only bringing in small numbers, but there's a bit of a difference. Let's talk numbers here quickly. This base model starts at 555,000 Rand. Sounds like a lot, but it's right there in the ballpark with the equivalently spec'd, or base spec, let's put it that way, 320 and C200 Audi A4 2-litre TFSI. If you do start specking it, the one that we drove came a little closer to about 590,000 Rand. So like 35,000 rands worth of extras on the one that we drove, which isn't much if you consider the extras, because those same extras are going to push you over the 600,000 rand mark in the 3 Series, the C Class and the A4. The QV is going to run you about 1.4 million. Oof. Okay, so there's a big hop there. There's a big hop, but go and sample this one and spec it spec for spec with some of the Germans, and you'll actually see that this is a great value proposition.
Okay, so all in all, a good car.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
fantastic. Brilliant. I mean, you guys both.
I'd love to
it.
Spend more time with it. I really would.
Yeah, that's all right. Very comfortable.
Maybe we can
nice
get it
car.
Back and take it around a track. That could be fun. Right, gents, let's get into talking tech. And I don't know if with obviously there's you know, in the tech world. In the digital age that we live in, stuff changes at such a quick pace. But I see Michelin have unveiled a 3D printed vision concept tire. There are videos on the net that you can go and check out. And it's so exciting to see where motoring is going and how the entire industry is going to change over time. But the Michelin Visionary Concept Tire was unveiled at an international summit for sustainable mobility and the summit's called Move On in Montreal, obviously in Canada. And the concept was, it's obviously intrigued many experts as well as the press. I don't know if you guys, we've obviously read the articles and we've, you know, had a quick look at the tire. But gentlemen, what are your thoughts on this?
I think the best part about this tire is that it's from recycled material.
Correct, yes.
Which means that there's no, you know, there's very little damage to the environment versus your traditional rubber tire. It's made of recyclable material. And then another big thing about this tire is that it doesn't use air to keep it, you know, rigid or up.
Yes. So you can't inflate it. So essentially, it's a tire that's got a solid structure to how it's built. And I see that they...
Well, it's a honeycomb structure. So I suppose the rigidity of it comes from that honeycomb structure.
Yeah, well, I see Michelin say that they've that it's called the generative design. And they've looked at plants and obviously what's happening in nature and how...
Biometrics,
yeah. Well, they're just copying, aren't they? Stuff that's been around for
and it's 3D printed, so you know, you can apparently print new tread onto this tire.
Well, so I watched the video this morning, and essentially, I mean, it's a concept video, and I think it is a bit of a stretch, but essentially, you're going to drive into the mountains, and all of a sudden it starts snowing. You can, you know, pull your car over to the side of the road. Now, in the video, it looks like you can reprint the tread that is going to be on the
tread
tire.
Design, yeah.
The tread design. So your snow tread or, you know, something for gravel or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, are they going to have these printing stations wherever you go when, you know?
So besides the
3D... What I was pulling from that was that the vehicle is going to do the printing itself.
Okay, well,
so the vehicle will print basically on the car. It'll reprint the tire. And that's one thing. But like a haircut, you can cut off, but you can't cut on.
Yes.
So once it's reprinted in your, you know, and here I come as once again the antagonist and the naysayer. So you've now encountered a little bit of snow and mud and you've printed your off-road tires. Mm. Great, now you're done. How do you take that tread off?
Well, you
wheel spin,
or just you got to reprint a new tread. Sorry, George, what were you going to say?
So this honeycomb structure, and you know, I'm talking a little bit off the top of my head, but I think it's been used before. Not the 3D printing bit, but the honeycomb structure in military vehicles. Mm. I saw a video not very long ago, a year and a half ago, where military vehicles were using this honeycomb structure so that the tire didn't have to be inflated. And it literally was almost indestructible. So I don't think this honeycomb structure is a new thing, but the 3D printing part.
Yeah, that's definitely new. Well, I mean, 3D printing is revolutionizing absolutely everything.
Absolutely, And I mean, the basis of this actually dials back to, and I want to say almost, probably close on 20 years.
Okay.
15 to 20 years ago when Michelin had, what was it, like an airless tire.
Yeah.
And it looked like a spoked wheel. Almost, and that the photos of that flew around the internet and on magazines and that for many, many years, talking about how these are going to be anti-puncture, no puncture tires, that sort of stuff. You'll never suffer from a puncture again or a blowout. And I think this is just an evolution of that. While we never saw that going into production, there were military applications, I believe, like you say. And this, I suppose, is just giving us a glimpse into the direction that Michelin is looking to take tire technology.
I think, you know, if you were going to poke holes at this, and clearly this is a tire that has got a lot of holes because of the structure of it, but if you're driving in mud,
isn't your tires, those holes, those little gaps are all going to fill up with gunk, with mud. With so gunk. What's that going to do to the weight of the tire and the distribution of the weight in the vehicle?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that that's anything that doesn't exist today.
Sure.
You know, if you've got tread on a tire and you drive through very thick, sticky mud, it's gonna happen anyway. So, you know, so I don't, something that they probably have to get over at some point with some other kind of technology. You know, maybe some sort of coating that the mud doesn't stick to. I don't know. But I don't think that's a new problem.
No. And do you think there are a lot of other tire manufacturers that are kind of going down this road? You know, as we're getting electric vehicles and we're moving ahead with technology. I mean, these guys are going to have to start doing something.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, tires are one of the only components left on the car that hasn't really significantly changed.
No, not in a massive way, hey?
Well, I mean, and what's it going to do? I mean, let's say these tires were all on our cars in the next 5 years. That's going to completely change the fitment industry. You know, what your garage at home is going to be, you know, you're going to be able to plug your car in at home and have tires printed so that you can go on a bouncy ride in the morning. I don't know. You know, it's really, really going to...
There's a lot of this that, and I mean, the indestructible tire does exist. It does exist, but sure. Nobody's going to manufacture it because they're in the business of selling tires.
Yeah,
you know, so they're going to want to sell tires, and that's why things like this generally take a little longer. You know, they're just showing and they're generating a little bit of interest and investment interest.
Unless
in it.
These companies, you know, they've made their money out of selling rubber over the, you know, last 30, 40, 50, 60 years, whatever it is. But I mean, they could go into new, you know, spheres. If you look at, you know, Apple getting into music and, you know.
And the pressure from, you know, environmentalists and the general, you know, ecosystem, the green movement is putting a lot of pressure on these sort of companies to be more efficient, to be more eco-conscious. So it shows that they are thinking about it and they're not just, you know, staving off the requests to be a little more eco-friendly.
Exactly. So, I mean, Michelin have got a 4R strategy, which you alluded to, which is, you know, to reduce, reuse, recycle and renew, which is really, really fantastic. So good job there from Michelin. Just quickly, just some other things that that we've seen in cars and, you know, where technology is taking us from a, you know, within the motor industry, you know, things like safety sensors on vehicles, panels. They're even saying that this Michelin tire will be able to kind of communicate with the onboards, the computer system in the vehicle, letting you know
what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that really is cool. I mean, safety sensors in panels on your vehicles. There's, you know, theft protection. I mean, are people going to be able to steal cars in the next 10, 15 years?
Well, we hope not.
I don't know if people are going to own cars in the next, you know, 20 years. It's, you know, ride sharing and self-driving vehicles, and it's like horses. You know, people don't not own horses anymore.
Yeah.
You just don't
have
see,
a horse and cart.
You don't see people commuting using a horse and
cart. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So you know, the industry itself will probably change in the next 20 to 30 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and just things like biometric vehicle access. I mean, if you look at how we get into the office, fingerprints. Otherwise, you're not coming in. And the same with,
we know how
with cars and their gate is full or whatever she says, the turntable. But yeah, so I just think it's really, really exciting. And obviously lots to look forward to. And a lot of industries that are changing. I think that's opportunities for innovation and for entrepreneurs to look at where the motor industries are going in South Africa and start, you know, plugging ideas in and really trying to take, you know, the industry forward. So that's just my 5 cents worth on.
No, it's really it's a really exciting time to actually be involved in the motoring industry and to be aware of cars and what's happening, because there is so much changing. It's a massive transitional phase that is no doubt going to go in the books to be one of those key points in
history,
in motoring, well, I mean, and in mobility.
Exactly. I mean, well, each one of those kind of features that cars are going to have is an industry in itself, isn't it? So, you know, it really, really is exciting, and we're definitely going places. Gents, just before we wrap up, is there anything to look forward to over the next couple of weeks or months? I know that we've got the SA Festival of Motoring that's coming up on from the 1st to the 3rd of September. And really, really, you know, nice to know that Auto Trader is the official digital partner to SA Festival of Motoring. So we will be having a show that just unpacks what that's all about. But I can't wait. I mean, what a great event last year.
It was great last year, and I'm only anticipating that it's going to be even bigger this year.
I think so too.
It was like the bike festival. I mean, last year was great. This year was even better. Same thing's going to happen,
100%. And then I know that the Land Rover Discovery 5 is coming out. I think Lawrence is currently on launch on the new Disco 5.
Disco 5, so you can take a look on our social media if you want to follow about what's happening with the Land Rover Disco 5. Lawrence is going to be updating our social media channel, so Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and that is going to be...
It's all there.
It's going to be alluding to what's coming up, and then, of course, there's going to be write-up with photos on that in the next day or
Fantastic.
Two on that.
And then next weekend, massive, massive F1 Grand Prix at Silverstone. And there's quite a bit, George, happening in the news about Silverstone, because apparently in their contract, they've got a, what is it, what do they call it? There's a hold-off clause or a stop clause that will allow them to renegotiate their contract. Because from the article that I read, apparently they're going to pay something like £17 million to house the Grand Prix.
Yeah, so the cost of a Grand Prix has to be factored into a country's national budget. So you can see what it takes to have one of these things. It's not just the venue that that kind of has to put their money where their mouth is. They have to get budgetary allocation for an event like the Formula One, and Silverstone isn't any different.
Well, home of Lewis Hamilton, naturally, mm-hmm. probably did a lot of racing.
Well, many of the teams are based in the UK, so it's basically a home ground for.
So they'll
many
all know
the
that
teams.
Track inside out. There.
Oh yeah,
yes. Oh no, and I mean, I don't want to say it's the birthplace, but it really has become the home and mecca of Formula One.
Well, I didn't know it was an old world. It used to be a World War II airfield.
The main straight, I think, is a runway.
Yeah. How's that?
Or an ex-runway.
I didn't know that. Yeah, but anyway, some really exciting stuff to look forward to.
Because they have the Red Bull Air Race there as well.
Yes.
Over that track.
Yeah. Over that space.
All right, guys. Yeah. Fantastic. Listen, unfortunately, we are out of time. That has been a fantastic show once again.
Awesome.
And repeated next week, and then we'll catch you live in... 2 weeks' time. Chad, George, thanks very much, guys.
Cheers. Great stuff. Have a good one. Cheers. This is CliffCentral.com.